The reading today is one of the quatrains from the Rubaiyat by the 12th century Persian mathematician and astronomer Omar Khayyam. The moving finger writes, and having writ moves on. Nor all your piety nor wit shall lure it back to cancel half a line, nor all thy tears wash out a word of it. Omar Khayyam is saying that what we see cannot be unseen, what we hear cannot be unheard, and what we read cannot be unread. That's true. What we need to consider is who is writing and why, and whether we can write new lines. This talk is about words and how they not only create our individual and collective reality, but can both obscure reality as well as provide a way to see things in a new and more understandable light. Lewis Carroll in Alice in Wonderland said, "When I use a word, it means just what I choose it to mean, neither more nor less." Brave talk, Lewis, but often it is the word or the collection of words that lead us around by the nose. I was most recently thinking about words and the power of words while watching the State of the Union address by President Trump. It was a long speech, but they usually are. Along the way, he brought up the subject of public schools. However, he didn't use the term public schools. He used the term government schools. I'm a big believer in public schools. I was formed by them, I vote for them, and I taught in them. But using the term government schools brings up a sort of dark and dreary perception of schooling, and of course, that was the intention. Words matter. They not only matter, but they create. I've always been interested in words. I remember in early elementary school being delighted by finding the word ain't in the dictionary, contrary to what our teacher, Miss Brown, said. Later in life, I learned that the name of the little button that locked the car door back then was sneck, and the sound that your joints make is crepus. I realized that everything has a name. Well, maybe not. Everything that we think is real has a name. If something is nameless, then it, for most of us, doesn't exist. We also know that words have both a literal meaning and an emotional meaning. A word like weep describes the production of tears, but the word itself evokes feeling of sadness. Very different from using the word ball to describe the same event. The president's use of the term government schools for public schools is a good example of creating a negative perception. For both Susan and me, it brought up a picture of Native American children being forcibly taken from their homes and put in third-rate boarding schools run by the Department of the Interior early in the last century. Government schools. I usually wake up in the middle of the night, as do most of us. I lie there and my mind just wanders. A while ago, it wandered back about 50 years to a story I have told before, but I love the telling of it. You are probably familiar with foul weather pants, the bright yellow rubberized bib overalls that protect a person from getting wet, whether being out in bad weather or working where there's a lot of water. I was gifted with a used pair of these pants. They were faded but serviceable and had in giant black letters on the front of the bib, Rufus Lucas, the name of the former owner. At the time, I used the pants as rain pants for riding my motorcycles and then later as fall weather gear for sailing on Humboldt Bay. I always referred to them as the Rufus Lucas pants. The family could have called them Dad's old rain pants, but they all came in to call them those Rufus Lucas pants. Years later, my oldest son was an oceanography major in college, and his class was about to take their first cruise offshore. They were required to bring foul weather gear. My son went to the marine supply store to get what he was required and was asked what he needed. He replied he wanted a pair of Rufus Lucas pants. After some explaining, he got what he wanted. We learn the meanings of words in lots of ways, and what we call things is important. Words can shape how we see things and can also shape how we feel about things. I've told the Rufus Lucas story many times, probably too many, but whenever I talk about the Rufus Lucas pants, the name always makes me smile. It's so wonderfully magical, musical. Even when motorcycling home from Canada and caught in a rainstorm, I smile as I dug the Rufus Lucas pants out of my pack. Words are important, and how we frame things is even more important. We can look at this group of us as a forlorn group of UUs. We have no building. We don't have the financial strength to afford a building. If we were given a building, we would struggle financially to maintain it. That sounds pretty desperate. However, we can frame that differently and see ourselves as being a church without walls, a congregation of celebrants whose fellowship and shared values bind us together more than four walls and a roof. A couple of months ago, I gave one of these talks and mentioned how I saw our UU not as a UU without a church, homeless, if you will, but as a congregation, a church without walls. Some might call that spin. Let's just call it reframing. Framing or reframing is a way or a new way of understanding something. I've used the term framing many times to describe the process of looking at something from a different perspective or putting a different affect on something. The perceptual impact of the term really hit home very recently. Susan does art and paints in watercolors. She was preparing a painting to be submitted to the local arts council. The painting was on an old beat-up car with "Runs Good" and "Make Offer" written on the windows of the car. The painting was of fairly light hues, and as she tried different frames, she said, "See how this one almost makes the painting disappear?" And it did. One frame seemed to wash out the painting, and another frame, or in addition to the first frame, made everything stand out. It was pretty obvious how applying the right structure or boundaries to something could enhance or diminish the contents. The frame creates a perceptual change. About a month ago, Reverend Rick Hoyt McDaniels gave a sermon titled "The Future Church." In the sermon, he pointed out how churches in 2020 were structured like they were in 1950. He suggested that the needs of the present population were not being very well met, and that a substantial portion of the population saw churches as being irrelevant or even were hostile to organized religion. Reverend Hoyt McDaniels said that people still needed certain things that they couldn't find through technology. One of them was community. He suggested that small churches could provide that community. We certainly qualify. Indeed, most churches in the U.S. have a membership under 100. Half of American churches have a weekly attendance of 80 or less. Susan and I helped to shape several social events in the congregation: book club just for favor, the Halloween party, and the holiday party. We do this because it's fun, but also because we think that social connections are the glue that helps to hold groups together, so to help provide a sense of community. The same thing applies to all the other affinity groups and to political activism and social justice, support for the environment, and what used to be called charity work in the community. By bringing us physically and emotionally together, all of those help to create and sustain our congregation community. The other two needs he identified were spirituality and a relationship with the theological tradition. Our affirmation states that we will seek truth and spiritual growth. Susan and I were conducting the New to UU class last month, in which I read the mission statement aloud. It includes our goal of encouraging and supporting spiritual growth. I remarked that we actually do that. My personal history is not one of being spiritual. My profession was as an academic psychologist and that's how I viewed the world. My years in this UU, however, have added a spiritual component to my life. It comes from being with this congregation, listening to the views of its members and those of professional theologians. It also comes from giving talks like this one. Sometimes we worry that we aren't growing fast enough. I don't think there's anything wrong with those thoughts, but we might try to frame the way we look at ourselves as doing a good job of meeting the needs of the people who attend. By focusing on doing that well, others may be drawn to us, or maybe not, but the important thing is to do the job we do best, meeting the spiritual and community needs of those who are part of our congregation. Framing ourselves as being already successful makes me think we don't really need a building of our own to be successful. So how can we apply the concept of framing to our national political being? The current frame is that one half of the country hates the other half and vice versa. Is there a way to reframe that? Not to make it sound nicer, but to help us understand ourselves better. I did run across another frame that said, one third of the country wants to kill a second third while the last third watches. Neither view is optimistic, but both share a view of seeing reality simplistically. Both sides see the other stereotypically and monolithically. The right is seen by the left as old, white, rural, male, poorly educated, and poorly informed. The right sees the left as young, inexperienced, non-white, elitist, female, and condescending. What has distressed me about the primary season, and not just this one, but others as well, is framing the primary in terms of winners and losers. After each Democratic debate, print and broadcast media would tell us who the winners and losers were. My thought was, wait a minute. We've got 12 people on stage answering sometimes strange questions from moderators, and we hear about winners and losers. This binary way of thinking about winners means that the others are losers, as opposed to being legitimate candidates who have earned a spot in the debate. It used to be that on Oscar night, the presenters, when awarding an Oscar, would say, "And the winner is." Fortunately, that has largely changed. Saying "the winner is" implies that the other wonderful movies and actors are all losers. Now most presenters say, "The Oscar goes to." There are no losers with that. Just one Oscar goes to one of the nominees. So perhaps a better approach to informing the public about the debates, other than a binary frame of winners and losers, would be to report which candidate talked most about policy, or which ones discussed the state of the nation in objective terms, or even which ones described how they would govern a nation that's deeply polarized. Indeed, the moderators could encourage that kind of discussion instead of asking candidate A how do they feel about what candidate B said about them 10 years ago. We are drawn to framing ourselves and others in a binary fashion, either or, in, out, good, bad, them, us. We're also drawn to seeing things in clumps, deplorables, libtards. Perhaps a more helpful approach might be to frame the body politic as composed of numerous factions that sometimes agree and sometimes not. The trick, which I do not know how to do, is to find one or two things that factions can agree on and see the value of cooperating instead of framing agreement as compromise and surrender. A politician might change their mind, or flip-flop, as a political opponent might describe it, or take another approach. President Obama's views on same-sex marriage evolved from opposition to support. The Australian Prime Minister, a famous climate change denier, states that his views of climate change are evolving after months of disastrous fires. Evolving implies change for the better, though we don't know the specifics of his evolution. What his evolution implies to my cynical self is that the Prime Minister is saying, "I'm confronted with overwhelming evidence that denying climate change is wrong. but my ego won't let me admit it. However, I would like to be reelected, so I'm moving towards sitting on the fence. How we frame things can also apply to self-evaluation. I'm afraid that too many people frame themselves like primary election debates as a winner or a loser. In my own experience as a young person, I pretty much thought of myself as the family screw-up. I made choices that others saw as bad ones. During my second year of college, I took the concept of sophomore slump to new heights. I didn't see things as going well. My ex-wife had a mother. My ex, a now late mother-in-law, had several vocations and avocations. Among these was being a palm reader, a person who will tell you what your life was, is, and will be by looking at the lines on your palm. During one of her visits, she read my palm and told me I had a lucky star. The lines in the palm formed a shape, very roughly, of a star. She said that this meant that luck was on my side. This interchange probably took less than half an hour, but the idea that I was lucky slowly wormed its way into my consciousness, and I began to see outcomes in my life as being lucky ones, and eventually seeing myself as having good luck. I remember hearing that Napoleon was once considering the promotion of one of his generals and said, "I know he's brilliant, but is he lucky?" My philosophy and the way I have framed my life, partly because of this, is that one shouldn't worry too much about mistakes. They might just turn into blessings. In honor of this frame, Susan and I named our old sailboat Lucky Star. There are many ways of thinking and communicating. Words are obvious ones. Individual words have great power, and linking words together to frame events have tremendous influence. The message here is to be thoughtful about the words and frames that we use to communicate to ourselves and others. I always like to close with the lyrics to a song or a poem. We typically frame poems as a source of images that arouse emotions. We can also frame poetry as being a concise form of information. Now, this talk has used a TED Talk time frame of 17 minutes. The following poem by Glenda Nowakowski, one of the members of our poetry group, takes less than a minute and conveys the sense of my talk. It's called Words. Words. I use words, big words, little words, middle-sized words. Sometimes I use those other words, like the language of Mordor, I will not repeat here. Words can dance around the matter or strike at the diseased, corrupted root. Words can starve or nourish, disdain or sustain. And yes, words can hurt you. Words can create the most splendid beauty or document utter devastation. Words can be truth, words can be lies, but never alternative facts. Words can dazzle and tantalize. Words can suck you in and mire you in evil. Words can help you find your way. Use your words, but always with care. Sometimes there are no words, and you have to reach down deep, nurture what you find, tend it with care, until empowered, it leaps onto the page. I use words. I try not to let words use me. Thank you for listening.